We love courtroom stuff, don't we? I mean, I can probably name every single one of those movies. I've seen them all. I mean, people love courtroom stuff. I mean, that movies about courtroom dramas has been a staple of TV and movies since the medium began. And you can see why, because it's got everything in it. It's drama. There's a mystery involved. Sometimes there's humor or comedy that comes up. And it's all there as people are watching this amazing thing play out as a judge determines or as a group of peers determines the guilt or innocence of persons accused of a crime. In the world of ancient Rome, communities were a lot more closely knit than we are in our present day world. And courts that, you know, were something that were carried out out in a public forum. They were something that was an open air event, basically. People were brought before a group of jurists and a magistrate, and they would play out this drama with two opposing sides determining innocence or guilt. They didn't, back in the ancient world, in ancient Rome, they didn't need dramatic representations of courtroom dramas because they had those things that they could go to on a regular basis. People who were accused of crimes or who had defrauded their neighbors were brought to the forum. It would be a large meeting space adjacent to the markets there. And people would gather around and they would listen to the two orators. They were the lawyers at that time. The lawyers back then weren't schooled in law. They were actually schooled in speech making, oratory. So whoever gave the best speech was the one who was going to win in that sort of scenario. But the seeds of our modern Western court system, judicial system, actually were planted there in ancient Rome and in Greece. That's where it all came from. And the reason I'm telling you all of this is because the section that we're going to read in Romans today is going to present Paul is going to present his case much like a civil court would have been conducted in the first century there in Rome. Paul's readers at that time would have been very familiar with the language that he's going to be using in this, and they would have immediately conjured up in their minds a courtroom scene. So it's important for us to get that kind of information so we also can conjure up a courtroom scene as we're reading what it is that Paul is going to be saying in this. If you have a Bible or a Bible app and would like to follow along, if you will find your way to Romans chapter 3, please. This is the final scene of the story that Paul's been setting up here. When he began this section, he stated that he wasn't ashamed of representing the gospel of Jesus because it's the good news that God is setting everything right and he's doing it through the Messiah, Jesus. And to show why it was necessary for everything to be set right, he described the conditions of humanity in this broken world outside of God's rule. He showed how everything has gone wrong. But just so that the Jewish readers, who were also part of this community that he was writing to, wouldn't start feeling superior to the Gentiles, he reminded them that 1,500 years of having the law didn't do anything to save them. They were still just as broken, and worse, they were broken and judgmental about it all. So last week, he went through and he painted a picture of just how ugly their hypocrisy had made them and how repellent that was to an unbelieving world who looked on and couldn't believe that people would represent a morality that they themselves didn't have conditioning their lives. So he was concluding last week that their religious behavior was of no use in fixing the problem of this broken world, that religious labels and badges were completely unuseful when it came to addressing the real problem that was facing this world. Worse, their religious hypocrisy was actually adding to the brokenness and driving people away from the only solution. So now today, like a lawyer who's wrapping up his case against the accused, Paul's going to set out the verdict for all people, for all of humanity, what our state is in contrast with the goodness of God. And we're going to consider his closing statements and what it is that it means for us today, how we're going to apply this to our own lives. So if you're there in Romans chapter 3, we'll begin with verse 1. He says, "Then what's the advantage of being a Jew? Is there any value in the ceremony of circumcision?" And again, he's anticipating an argument that somebody's going to be making to him. So he provides the question for his readers. So imagine it then like a courtroom scene where suddenly the defense lawyer jumps up and says, "Objection, Your Honor. Is the prosecution seriously trying to say that the Jewish people had no special place, that Jewish customs had no relevance whatsoever? And given everything that Paul has said up to this point, we might assume that his answer would be no. You know, is there any special privilege given? Is there any advantage to being a Jewish person?" We could imagine Paul, after everything else, saying, "Oh, no, not any advantage at all." But surprise, he actually counter-argues in verse 2. Yes, there are great benefits. First of all, or first and foremost, the Jewish people were entrusted with the whole revelation of God. True, some of them were unfaithful, but just because they were unfaithful, does that mean God will be unfaithful? Of course not. Even if everyone else is a liar, God is true. As the scriptures say about him, you'll be proved right in what you say and you'll win your case in court. But, some might say, our sinfulness serves a good purpose, for it helps people see how righteous God is. Isn't it unfair then for him to punish us? This is merely a human point of view. Of course not. If God were not entirely fair, how could he be qualified to judge the world? But, someone might still argue, how can God condemn me as a sinner if my dishonesty highlights his truthfulness and brings him more glory? And some even slander us by claiming that we say the more we sin, the better it is. Those who say such things deserve to be condemned. Okay, so Paul is stating plainly that the 2,000 years from Abraham to Jesus weren't just wasted years. God wasn't just killing time until he could find some other plan that would work a little bit better along the way to save people. No. He says the supreme value of the Jewish heritage was that they'd been entrusted with the revelation of God, that he is the creator. This is the revelation that we find in the Old Testament, that God is the creator, that this world is broken, but he's got a plan to redeem, to bring us out of exile. And I'll tell you what, that is a theme that's repeated over and over and over in the Old Testament. If you read the Old Testament, read it with that thematic concept in mind, you'll be amazed at how often that is repeated until we get to the point where Jesus brings it into a whole new meaning. So that revelation of the state of this world and who the Creator is was entrusted to the Jewish people. They were stewards of that truth, but as he states in here, they mishandled that truth. Robbie likes to watch a lot of crime shows. I don't know if I've mentioned that before, but you know those true life crime show things that they got on? Anybody watch those things? Okay, so you got a few people. Of course, your hand is up. Yes. Happy Mother's Day. It's not my thing. It's nice. I'm glad she likes to figure out how the woman plotted to murder her husband. But either way, so she likes to watch those shows, and one of them was a show about American Greed or something like that. And I just happened to be in the room and I was watching the whole thing, but it was fascinating. Yeah, it was fascinating. Okay, y'all concede. So here's this guy. He worked for a firm, a financial firm that was supposed to look after the trust fund of an elderly widow. It was a multi-million dollar trust fund. I mean, a lot of money. And he was managing it. But you know, when he's managing her money, it's not his money. We all understand how a trust works, right? I mean, you know, he might have made some ancillary profit off of that money that's there, but it wasn't his money. It was even money that really was a trust. That meant it was even for somebody else. It was for another purpose or designation. But this guy started siphoning funds off of this widow's trust, and he started buying himself expensive planes, World War II planes, and all kinds of things. He started flashing himself around as though he was this really big wheeler dealer and multimillionaire, and started his own little schemes on the side. This guy squandered $52 million in 6 months' time. It's just astounding. So he was unfaithful, right, to say the least, when it came to what was entrusted to him. This is what Paul's describing here. The Jewish people had been entrusted with this revelation of God, but it wasn't just for them. They were to be a light to the Gentiles. This was something entrusted to them for the whole world. But like that guy, they misused what they had. They treated it like it was theirs alone. They waved it around. They made themselves look important, and they used it at times as a weapon. So his point is, the stewards of God's plan were just as broken as the rest of the world. The stewards were just as broken as those that they were intended to try to help. But the underlying point that's being made in that, that's his outlying answer to the first argument. But the underlying point of that is really phenomenal. That in this courtroom scene, what all of a sudden Paul is pointing to is God's faithfulness. He's saying, sure, some people were unfaithful with this, but God's faithfulness, spurred by his love for his creation, never gave up on any of us. As unfaithful as the stewards were, as unfaithful as all of us have been, he never gave up. The broken state of this world has never restricted God's intent to redeem it. We were singing about that in multiple ways this morning, about how we don't do this well, and yet God's faithfulness never gives up. It's just a reminder that our ability or our inability is not what God's plan to redeem all things is based on. God didn't bring about salvation through Jesus because Israel had finished her assignment so masterfully. It wasn't because Israel had just done such a bang-up job of making sure everything was ready. No, on the contrary, Israel failed and failed over and over again, to the point that when God did send his answer, he did send Messiah, they rejected him and were instrumental in his death. He's setting the stage for a dynamic pronouncement that he's going to make a little later on. But the point here is that God's faithfulness is not limited to nor restricted by our failures and flaws. And that is good news. That's very good news. But he gives a qualifier as well. Because, again, imagine the courtroom. And the defense lawyer stands up and says, "Objection, Your Honor. Is the prosecution trying to imply that since we're so prone to moral failure that it makes no difference how we live then? If it's true that God is just and good but loving and forgiving, then isn't it unfair that he judges us when we're doing just what's coming naturally? I mean, if it glorifies him when he's merciful to us, then wouldn't the prosecution be implying that we just do whatever we want? Is he saying that God is better revealed as graceful and loving the worse off we are?" And so Paul responds, "No, that's not what I'm saying at all. God wouldn't be a just judge if he didn't care about the broken state of this world." One old British preacher one time said that you're never really truly preaching grace the way Paul preached it unless you're accused of being lawless. and he's right. And this is what Paul had to contend with over and over again. And Paul makes it very personal here. He says, he's obviously responding to some mischaracterization of his own ministry when he was saying, some people even spread around that we teach some sort of lawlessness. Paul, he's a false teacher. He says that the more we sin, the more God is glorified. So I'll just write him off. And he's going to actually come back to this issue later on in the book. So we'll deal with that more then. But obviously, Paul isn't telling us that morality has no bearing on things. He's not saying that sin is inconsequential or we don't need to think about choices that we make in life or that right or wrong have no bearing on anything. No, all of that is very important stuff. But his point is that God's redeeming plan transcends those issues. That our salvation is not resting on the precarious thread of our ability to remain faithful to God. Our salvation is not resting on that. We should, listen, this is Pastor Rob. This is Rob as the pastor saying, listen, remain faithful. That's our calling as followers of Jesus. We want to remain faithful. We want to follow Christ into wholeness and into real humanness. We don't want to cooperate with the broken habits and the patterns that ruin and destroy what God made good. We don't want to remain friends with sin and death. But don't ever once imagine that behaving well is the key to salvation. Because that key to salvation comes in the form of a cross. That key is something someone else has to provide for us. Sola gratia, the Latin term coined by the reformers, salvation by grace alone, not by our efforts or our ability to do this well. So Paul has presented us with this long and tawdry history of human failure and flaws, of inescapable habits and an outright rejection of what's good, and yet none of it got in the way of God's plan to redeem. As bad as it got, as terrible as things have seemed, even in our own histories, as bad a choices as we've made, none of it has been able to resist God or stop God from fulfilling what it is that he wants to do. He never gives up. He never gives up on us. He never gives up on you. Why would he give up on you? He paid a great price for you. He loves you. All right, well, we continue. The court scene goes on, verse 9. Well, then, should we conclude that we Jews are better than others? No, not at all. For we've already shown that all people, whether Jews or Gentiles, are under the power of sin. As the scriptures say, no one is righteous, not even one. No one is truly wise. No one is seeking God. All have turned away. All have become useless. No one does good, not a single one. Their talk is foul like the stench from an open grave. Their tongues are filled with lies. Snake venom drips from their lips. Their mouths are full of cursing and bitterness. They rush to commit murder. Destruction and misery always follow them. They don't know where to find peace. They have no fear of God at all. Happy Mother's Day. So Paul, speaking like a prosecutor, he moves on to Exhibit B. And he's reintroducing this idea of Jewish advantage or Jewish superiority. Are we Jews better than others? He says. He's including himself in this now. And his answer is a flat no in this case. Not at all. No one is righteous. And again, he's going to revisit this a little later on, so we won't jump that point. But this is a pivotal moment in the case that he's been building since chapter 1. And so let's real quick remember the context. Humanity is broken in a fallen world. But the answer for that brokenness is not religious behavior, which no one can attend to perfectly. So then, what's the point of the Jewish story? If religion isn't a fix, then why the Jewish heritage? Why do we have the Jewish faith? Well, because God entrusted the revelation of his plan to redeem within that faith. Now, here he's finalizing his point. The nations of this world have been trapped by the brokenness of sin. The Gentile world stands in the docks, guilty before God. But then Paul sweeps his hand over to Israel and says, they are also broken and guilty, standing before God. Everyone is trapped. This is the point that he's making. He's building to something, but this is where he's at this point. That God has to rescue all of humanity, religious or irreligious, from the domination of sin and death. And he speaks of being under the power of sin. And this is what's really interesting about Paul as he's going to be telling this story through the book of Romans, that sin and death are represented almost as characters in this drama. You know, he's not pointing out specific manifestations of sin like he did in chapter 1, but he's showing the big picture. Sin is a power. It's a force at work in this world, a force which has held the human race in captivity. And he makes it clear that this force of sin is distinct from humanity, but also at work through humanity. And he's going to revisit this again in chapter 7. So he's kind of setting the stage for things he's going to say a little later on. He'll elaborate on that there. But it's a very important distinction that we want to keep in mind that Paul is even referencing here. The idea of being in bondage to sin, sin as a force that is distinct and separate actually from the human creation. Sin isn't just about the specific sets of manifested behavior that we see people engage in. It is a state of being. It's a mindset which influences humanity away from God's purposes. When we're thinking of sin, that's one of the things that we fall into so often, is that we think in terms of sin, and we like to start narrowing it down to the specific manifestations. But the biblical concept of sin is much greater than that. It's far more pervasive than just a few little attitudinal or behavioral things that can be fixed. This has to do with a mindset. It has to do with the influence of life. Religion can't fix that, because all religion can do is modify behavior externally. It can't break the influence that's causing the behavior. It can't overthrow the dominating power that's causing this. So Paul, he rattles off a series of quotes from the Old Testament about human sinfulness. None of those have I ever found on a calendar anywhere with a Thomas Kincaid painting. But either way, most of them are from the Psalms. One of them is from Isaiah. And all of these passages are describing humanity at its worst, the way that evil has worked through humanity in the world. But if you take the time, if you got a Bible that has the cross references, go through and there's a little assignment for you. Read the passages that he's quoting from, because in each case, those pronouncements about that evil are immediately followed by the promise that God is going to rescue those who are helpless against evil. And that last quote from Isaiah is followed by the promise, so God himself stepped in to save them with his strong arm. The Redeemer will come to Jerusalem to ransom Israel. In spite of the evil and the force of sin dominating and working through humanity, God will make good on his plan for rescue. That's what's being emphasized. And I'm pretty sure that Paul, being the scholar that he was, had the larger context in view, even as he used those passages to describe the human condition. And so he's leading us to something, Paul is. He's trying to point us in a direction that he's going. The good news that Paul has not yet elaborated on in this section here, he'll get to it. But finally this morning, let's read the verdict that Paul gives in verses 19 and 20. Obviously, he says, the law applies to those to whom it was given. For its purpose is to keep people from having excuses and to show that the entire world is guilty before God. For no one can ever be made right with God by doing what the law commands. The law simply shows us how sinful we are. So this concluded Paul's description of the broken world in two parts. That's what we set up in chapter one. Paul was going to describe this world and its condition in two different phases. First, the Gentile world is broken. It's broken and dominated by sin. But then he moves on and says the Jewish world also, even with the law, unable to keep the law, is broken. They still are under the force of sin and death. And of course, the question is why? And this is what Paul's answering. Why didn't the law rescue the Jewish people? Why didn't it save them? Why is it that the law was not capable of bringing the Jewish people out of the exile that they had known? If we take it in the larger picture, why is it that Paul is stating here that the law, that religious codes of behavior are incapable of bringing humanity out of the exile of sin and back into reconciliation with God? Paul states it in the verdict. The law can't do it. It was never the function of the law to do that. God never gave the law to Israel with the hopes that Israel one day would finally fully keep it and fulfill it and then be reconciled with God. That was never the law's intent. The law, excuse me, was simply an X-ray machine. The law was like an MRI, something that diagnosed the problem. You know, if a person gets internal pain, some serious internal pain, and they go to the doctor, and the doctor orders up an X-ray. We got to see what's going on in there. And, you know, you go in and you get the X-ray. Well, she didn't order that X-ray, you know, as the cure. You don't walk away from the X-ray saying, well, there we go. You know, I've got a mass right here, so I'm okay now. Well, wait, what are you going to do about that? I don't need to do anything. I got an X-ray right here. Nobody ever assumed that the X-ray was the thing that was the cure. No, there's other things that are going on there. It's just a device to reveal what's going on beneath the surface. And all the law could do was reveal what happens to the human race when we determine to live without God, when humanity tried to create our own paradise apart from God. It reveals what we actually become. The law could never make us right with God. No set of rules or religious codes could ever do that. Now, we're going to cover it next week, but just so that we don't have to end on that note, I just want to briefly look ahead, because Paul flips on the light. He's gotten the room really dark. He's got all the lights out, and everybody's kind of blinking and going, okay, wow, this is awesome. Glad I came to church. And then he writes in verse 21, but now God has shown us a way to be made right with him without keeping the requirements of the law. Salvation, rescue from the domination of sin and death apart from the law. And he'll give the big reveal next time, but here's a spoiler. It's Jesus. This is all this that has been building off of this statement that Paul made earlier. I'm not ashamed of the gospel of Jesus. Oh man, no. I'm not ashamed of that, because it's the power of God for salvation. What everything else failed to be able to do, God accomplished through Christ in my heart. That's why the purpose of the church was never to introduce a new religion. It was never to set up a new code of moralism that commanded everyone to conform to. We were never commissioned to impose a new set of behavioral modifications that we use then as a standard to determine who's right with God. Paul makes it very clear here. Religious rules simply amplify the problem. Only God's grace, only God at work in our hearts, internally, systemically, is going to actually bring about real righteousness and salvation. I mean, who has ever gotten better by having heavy moral obligations set over them? Whoever gets better under those conditions? One philosopher said, a religious atmosphere that emphasizes rules and obligations only succeeds in producing monks or madmen. And I speak from painful experience to the validity and truth of that statement. I never got better. In the years that I spent under the domination of religious rules and constrictions of a legalistic atmosphere, I never got better. I only got worse. I only felt worse. I only felt condemned. I never knew the joy of what it meant to fall into the arms of a Savior who loves me, who loves me, who never gave up on me. Moralism can't make people better. It can only make people weirder or more uptight, and that is not God's intent. You can quote me on that if you want to. God declares salvation, the return from exile, the systematic change that results in our freedom from the domination of sin, that then does result in changed life. And that salvation is not administered by me. It's not administered by you. It's not administered by any code of conduct. It's the result of God's grace as he unfolds it according to his will in our lives and according to his timing in our lives. Change will happen. Morals will be affected. Our behavior will be modified, but not through outward conformity to a religious code, rather through the inward transformation that's accomplished by the Spirit of God as he releases us from that bondage and reveals to us what it means to really be human. So to sum it all up, the world is broken. Attempts to reform the broken world through religion are just as broken. All of humanity, religious or irreligious, stands in the same state of ruin and guilt, but all is not lost. God's plan to redeem all things was never thrown off by our fallenness. God's intent to set things right was never ruined by our ruination. God will never give up on us. So let's surrender to the Spirit's work. Let's allow the Holy Spirit to shape our own lives. As we learned last week, let's take our eyes off of our neighbors and not try to manage them. Let's allow the Holy Spirit to transform us, our own hearts. Let's throw moralism and judgmentalism aside. Let's kick it to the curb where it belongs. It has no place here. It does no good here. We want real transformation. We want real righteousness. It's only going to come through the work of the Holy Spirit in our hearts and in our lives. Let's embrace all of the possibilities of a new way to live through Christ. And then let's trust Jesus to do what religion could never do. Right on? All right, very cool. Why don't you stand up with me, if you will, please.